Hey everybody, welcome to Sound Bombing. I created this show for people who want to experience a radical, life-changing journey through the sounds of my diverse guests. I hope that each sound you hear on this show will strengthen your faith, encourage your dreams, and challenge you to awaken the greatness within you.
Drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We're gonna drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We're gonna drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
We come to drop the bomb.
Drop the bomb.
This is a journey into sound. A journey which along the way will bring to you new color, new dimension, new values, and a new experience.
Lamar Darnell Shields.
Inhale, sound bombing community. Inhale, and then exhale. Let's do that two more times. Inhale, and then exhale. One more time. Inhale, hold it 3 seconds. Exhale. Sound bombers, we know what that is. That is the breath of life. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. I just want to thank you for joining me today. It's your friend, Dr. Lamar Darnell Shields. And again, as always, I am so grateful and honored that you decided to spend some time with me today, wherever you are, in your car, walking, listening to your headset, listening on your radio, listening to your computer. However we're connected, we are connected because we're connected what I call the breath of life. And so I'm so grateful and honored that you decided to join me today in the bomb shelter. And sound bombers, if you listened to the show last week, and many of you all did, you are blown away with my guest, Andrew Phelps, not related to the swimmer, Michael Phelps. That's an inside joke. If you listen to the show, you know what I'm talking about. Because how ironic, Andrew Phelps was on the show last week, is a swimmer, was a lifeguard, and then Michael Phelps, who lives in the city that I currently live in. But he said there's no connection. But Andrew talked about creativity and during this COVID virus and how creators and innovators are staying innovative during this time. So he was amazing. Thank you for all of the comments. Thank you for the emails. And thank you for just checking in with us. And if you want to know more about me, definitely go to drlds.com. Not an MD. I'm not an MD. I'm a PhD. drlds.com. And today's show is no different from any other show because we always bring on some of the best and the brightest, and today is no different. About to take some of you all way, way back. There was a movie out, starred a guy by the name of, some people confuse him with Samuel Jackson, which is interesting because they're not the same people. Who am I talking about? Not Samuel Jackson. I am talking about a guy by the name of Lawrence Fishburne. I don't know why people confuse Samuel Jackson and Lawrence Fishburne. That's a whole other conversation. But in this sci-fi movie, The Matrix, there's a sequence in which Neo goes to meet the Oracle for the first time. He meets a bunch of potentials in the scene, from amongst whom one young boy in this particular interacts with Neo. The boy picks up a spoon and bends it without any physical interaction with the metal, supposedly using the power of telekinesis. He tells Neo this: it's not the spoon that bends it, it's only you. The Matrix is one of the favorite films of today's guest, Jonathan Pritchard. Pritchard is a famed magician, martial arts expert, and professional mentalist, reads minds, makes magic, and creates illusions like no one else. So do you believe that minds can be read? Is communication only about the hobgoblin of utterance, or is there something intangible to it? If mind reading has intrigued you like it's intrigued me, and you believe in a better purity of communications, you are going to enjoy today's show. Jonathan Pritchard has entertained the troops stationed overseas, performed on Vegas main stages, appeared on national television shows, like one of my favorite shows, America's Got Talent, and checked off every box for success as an entertainer, or could think as an entertainer, but he felt like something was missing. Jonathan realized he enjoyed talking with people, and of course, I do the same, with people after the show about how he found a way to make a living doing what he loves and helping them dream bigger in their own lives. This led him to his first coaching client and ignited his passion to share what he knows. That's when he decided to open the curtains and explain how psychology he uses on stage to get people to think he can read minds is exactly the same psychology that drives effective communication, influence negotiation, and increases sales. This led to the founding of his experiential design company, Hellstrom Group, writing books like Think Like a Mind Reader and Learn Like a Mind Reader. Jonathan realized he could do more good for the world if he helped companies and entrepreneurs make massive change on fundamental level in order to improve the employee experience, customer experience, and world in general. He truly believes that to improve yourself is to improve the world once you accept the responsibility of owning your own success. That's why he's on a mission to help people like you transform their thinking and create a life they've never dreamed that was possible. And that's why I invited him to join me today in the Bomb Shelter to help us understand how the art of mind reading works and how to know if someone is lying, if it's possible to communicate without a conversation, and how he creates magic out of the mind of reading. Jonathan, welcome to the show, man.
Man, that is a phenomenal intro. I want that in front of all my speaking gigs. Anywhere I go, I want to have that just play. Like that was phenomenal. Thank you.
Man, because you are amazing, man. Because what I love about your intro, when people introduce you, you always say, I deserve all of that. I deserve everything they say. Sometimes, Jonathan, when people introduce me, I'm looking around the room like, who in the ham sandwich are they talking about? They can't be talking about the little boy who grew up in Chicago that was kicked out of school. I mean, I was asked to leave school. Don't judge me, Jonathan. I was asked to leave. I went to Catholic school, so you don't get kicked out. You just get asked to leave.
Right.
But I love how you start your shows off, and you say, I deserve all of that, because I'm sure based on what my engineer has sent to me and based on what my producer, you done put some people through some stuff, homeboy.
Yeah, that was a very carefully crafted first words that I say in every performance or lecture or presentation, whatever. Mm-hmm. I come out because it fits, even if there's no applause, even if it's wild, raucous applause, right? It's like, you don't know it yet, but I deserved every bit of that. Right? So it communicates, you're like, okay, this guy has some confidence. he's got it in spades. And the approach is saying, yeah, I'm the best in the world at this. Then the first things I do is demonstrate that, yep, I can do things that normal human beings can't. Then once the audience has what they're expecting, right, that's what they're paying for, is to watch a guy do something that they can't do. Wow, that's impressive. And go, yeah, that's cool. But let me show you what you guys can do. And then that's the whole rest of the show. So it's kind of accepting the mantle of them wanting to be in the presence of somebody who is amazing, and then fulfilling those expectations so that they kind of go, yeah, okay, this is cool. This is what I was hoping for. Then once they're kind of on board, you can take them anywhere. And that's why the rest of everything I do, I see it as kind of a facilitator for them to do amazing things that they may not even know how it is they did it, but it helps them question, wait a minute, I thought I wasn't going to be able to pull that off. Somehow it happened. So maybe outside this context, there's other stuff that I would be able to do that I don't think I can right now. And then that's the little seed. That's the seed of confidence, of self, like that, yeah, I can do that. Right. So that's kind of at the heart of everything I want to do.
Well, that is a great way to start the show. I was so excited to bring you on board because my son and I love the show Brain Games, Brain Wars, any brain show, any show that challenges the brain, these brain hacks. But let me back up for a second. So in my intro, I talked about the famous scene in The Matrix. And when my producer sent me your bio and information about you, she said that that was your favorite movie. Do you remember that scene in the movie when Neo and this young person were in that space together? And then what is it about The Matrix that excites you about that film and about what you actually do?
Oh, yeah. I remember what theater I was in, right? It was in Virginia Beach. I was visiting my brother who was in the military. And it's my family. We're all going up there for his graduation from there. And we all went to the movies and had no clue what The Matrix was. And then just watched it. And I was just like, he knows Kung Fu. You can just download Kung Fu. You can bend metal. Oh, that's so cool. Right. So to me, it was just the coolest thing ever. And then it also is a really good framework to approach the nature of how you think about the world dictates the reality that's possible. So it's really deep medicine, man. it's amazing how deep those lessons can go. So in specific to the metal bending, it's kind of interesting because one of my mentors, his name is James Randi, and he had $1 million challenge to anybody who claimed to have kind of special psychic abilities and that kind of thing, right? And back in the day, in the 70s, there was a dude named Uri Geller who made the rounds on all the Tonight Shows. And
I remember that.
So he would bend metal with his mind. And he claimed to really have the mojo, right? And then my mentor, Randi, who's a magician, would come on the same shows and say, I'm not saying he can't do what he says he can do. I'm just saying that I can do it exactly the same way, and I'm not using mojo. I'm just using trickery, right? So it was kind of cool to see that moment in the movie and to know personally some of the people who helped make that spoon bending thing a culturally kind of relevant trope for the power of the mind. So that was just kind of cool. I was like, I know those guys. I know where they got that from.
So what's the phenomenon? And I love The Matrix, man, but what's the phenomenon behind that film? Why do you think that film was such a box breaking hit than almost these other films? And then what was it about that film that attracted you about that at that time? And yeah, so let's go ahead with that.
I think it is a movie that deals with really deep subjects, like how do we know what is real? And if it's even possible to know what's real, and even if it is possible to know what's real, there are people who definitely don't want to know it. They're comfortable in their matrix. And if they haven't woken up to the reality of life and how things work, if you try to push them in that direction, they could be an agent who fights for the system that's keeping them asleep, right? Like it's straight up. You're like, yeah, I've known people like that, right? Just like arguing and fighting for their limits, right? So that's super, super difficult to experience. On the other side, it also has Kung Fu. Like that's awesome, right? So it's a movie that deals with some heavy hitting topics while also being able to mix in the fun adventure, fist flying, high kicks, kind of adventure stuff while still being a movie that deals with some big subjects. So it just kind of, it covers all the bases for me. Just like,
yeah, I think it hits on everything, issues around life, issues of what's taking place right now. And that's why I think the film, just to concur with what you said, I think it just sort of just took off, because the reality is whatever the mind can conceive, the mind can actually create in real time. And so when I look at these films like that, from Star Wars to all these other type of films, if someone can create that, it's taking place somewhere in real time in another space, in another dimension. And so that, you know, there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but let's start with the title Mentalist. Yeah. So in your bio, you consider yourself a mentalist. What is a mentalist or a professional mind reader? Mm-hmm. And how did you become a professional mind reader or a mentalist?
Cool. A mentalist to me is essentially a magician who has specialized in mind reading skills. So on stage, I can apparently read people's minds, tell the future, all that kind of ESP stuff. I do that on stage. Mm-hmm. Now, it works off applied psychology, showmanship, and just having the gumption to do it, right? So it's all based off rock solid communication skills. Like that's really at the heart of it. I usually say I'm a mind reader, because people can at least approach that. Mentalist isn't so common as, wait, you're a mind reader? Prove it. Like, all right, then go through a trick. So my first paid gig was when I was 13 years old. I got paid $200 to go do tricks at this company's summer picnic for their employees and their families. So I was just walking around doing tricks for people, having a great time, and got paid $200. I was like, this is awesome. And that was the path, man. That, like, good luck trying to get me to sit in a cubicle. That was never going to happen.
That's big money, 13 and, you know, a couple of $100, man. That's a big deal. So,
exactly.
So why did you choose such an unorthodox profession? I mean, you could have chosen anything, but you decided to sort of focus on this particular area.
Thinking back, because I'm 37 years old now, mm-hmm. thinking back to when I was 5 or 6 years old, when I first kind of got interested in magic tricks, I believe I got started in it because it was just interesting and fascinating. And it was a thing I wanted to know how it works. How does that trick work? Okay, that's cool. I stuck with it because it provides a context for me to explore my curiosity in any way. Like, I have my degree is in painting. Like, I don't have a degree in psychology or anything. Like, I'm a visual artist by training. I'm a mentalist by experience. Well, if I wanted to put my painting skills to use, well, I make a poster. I make a postcard to promote the show, right? I can design the props. I can build a website to explain, hey, I got a new show coming up, right? So it's every single facet of what I find interesting about the world has a place in my role as a mentalist. And like down to me doing martial arts, right? Watching The Matrix is really that thing, like, wait a minute, maybe I could learn Kung Fu, right? That was that first moment. And everything I've learned from being a martial artist shows up as a mentalist, being on stage and literally being able to hold your ground, to stand in one place and withstand the attention of 1,000 people in one room. That takes a lot of self-control and self-awareness and understanding that every single gesture is being watched, that every single thing you say and do goes into the message that you're communicating. So no extraneous movement. Make every movement matter. So it's just the coolest context that I've ever found. Anything else I've ever done, I've had to leave a little piece of me off to the side because, well, that's not really relevant to right now. But in my role as a mentalist, socially, culturally, just... It has application at whatever scale you want to look at it from.
So is mentalism both science and art, and is it a practice that can actually be taught?
Absolutely can be taught. I don't have mojo. I'm not naturally outgoing. I'm actually super introverted. Like, I'm just fine talking to nobody for weeks.
It's like, so the quarantine has been working for you, huh?
I've had zero difference in my daily life. Like, sure, all of my speaking gigs got canceled for the next year.
I know that feel. Are you able to, I'm going to come back to that question.
Yeah.
But so I know, like me, like you and I, we travel a lot lecturing. So are you able to do any of that virtually at all?
Kind of.
Okay.
But part of it is I'm on the fence about the virtual thing because it is amazing. Mm-hmm. Like I can teach people Kung Fu through video chat, mm-hmm. because if you think of it like you're learning choreography okay, cool. You're just following along and there's somebody watching. So there you go. It's cool. On the other end of it, the mentalism stuff, the actual human communication, there's so much lost when you're not in person.
Gotcha.
And it's, think of it kind of like learning to ballroom dance. You could learn the moves, but man, it's not partner dancing.
So I get it. Okay. All right. So yeah. Just like my work has slowed down and it's some of the stuff is difficult to do virtually. So you would talk, I didn't mean to cut you off, but when you talked about, so science and art, and it can be taught, explain that.
Right. Because early on when I was a kid and I was learning magic tricks, and because every beginning magic book has, here's some card tricks, here's some coin tricks, some rope tricks, some mind reading tricks, stuff you can do with stuff you find around the house. I'm like, wait, go back one, go back. Mind reading tricks, right? So it just says, here's the effect that it is. You want to help your audience believe you could read minds or predict the future. That's the effect you're going to do. All right, so here's the method. Here's what you need to do in order to create that effect. All right. So here are the props you need. Here's how you need to handle them. Here's the sequence of things you're going to say, right? So it's just like a recipe. So you go through it and then I would perform the trick for my dad or my mom and they'd be like, oh, that's really cool. And then my dad would be like, hey, Jonathan, I saw the coin in your hand. You were hiding it and you flashed it. I could see it. And I was like, what? I thought I did everything. Well, it's not just doing the right things. You've got to do the right things the right way. Then you've got to do the right things the right way at the right time. Even if you do all of that, right? So you've got to manage every single detail properly in order for the effect to happen. So you just learn how to manage those details. You learn how to memorize your script, how to deliver your script properly at the right pacing. Also physically doing stuff that you need to do. Pick up this, put down that, hide this in my hand, act like I don't have something when I do, right? So you just learn to manage all those details. So the effect is really metaphysical. The effect only lives in the mind of the audience. And that can only exist if you properly manage the base layer method, right? So it's weird. Magic doesn't happen by magic. Magic happens through years and years of practice and attention. A way I like to help people approach it is to think of it like, imagine if you were a painter and you wanted to paint this creature that doesn't actually exist, but you wanted your painting to look very realistic and believable, right? How would you get there from zero? Well, first, you learn about paints, you learn about brushes, the canvas. You probably spend years painting still life or somebody actually in front of you to learn how to represent reality perfectly. So imagine you could paint at photorealistic skill level, right? You'd be like, wow, that you captured every single detail. So first you need to learn how reality works before you have the skills to create a believable thing that doesn't actually exist, right? So if you're looking to communicate with people, you first need to know how people communicate, how they hear things, what they're hearing through their mindset, their belief structures, all of that. Then you can communicate more effectively and directly. Even if it's not literally true, you're much more effective at communicating the truth, right? Like Aesop's fables and parables. And I don't care if it was real or not, is it useful in communicating truth about life?
Now, so speaking about communicating, reading people's minds is very intriguing for sure, but it's also scary because you're stepping into another's intimate territory. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. That one point is one of the difficult things about figuring out where to go in a performance or conversation or whatnot. Because if they didn't know that this was a performance, it would be terrifying, right? Be like, oh my God.
Yes.
The thing I thought was absolutely like private, he just told me everything, right? So I straight up during my shows, I'm like, listen, this is a volunteer basis only thing. We're very much about consent here. If you don't want me digging around in your secrets, I'm not going to. So there's this pendulum of, okay, there's amazement on one end of absolutely terrifying, oh my goodness, he's reaching inside my brain and telling all my dirty secrets. And then on the opposite end is, you know, this is just lighthearted fun and we're just laughing and having a good time, but there's no amazement to it. Even though it's amusing, it's not amazing. Yeah. So I've had to find that strike that balance of not too many chuckles, because then it undercuts the impact of blowing people's minds apart and making them question the limits they believe are real. But then if you go too far that direction, well, now it's not entertaining. It's just scary.
Yeah. So speaking of scary, which are the top two traits you've read in people which they are most uncomfortable acknowledging?
Ooh. That's, I've never been asked that. I actually have to think about
that. Hey, this is why we do our show, man. We asking the questions that other people don't ask you, and we asking the questions that my audience want to know.
Because
you are going into some uncomfortable territory. Because I've asked this question of a seer. You know what seers are? People
who have this gift. Oh, yeah.
And I've asked, and my guest that was on last weekend, who is from, she's actually in Portugal. And I asked her, are some things that you saw that you didn't want? She was like, yeah, that's some stuff. I was like, I'm not touching that. I'm not ready for that. So thinking about that, you know, are there some things that you found somewhat uncomfortable?
Yeah, part of it is not allowing people to know how much about them you can see just by looking at what's already there. Mm-hmm. Right? It's kind of like if you're a master at something and then there's a beginner, like, dude, you see this all the time on Twitter, right? People who are arguing from a place of ignorance. And
we're seeing a lot of that right now with the pandemic and the killing of Black men and women by law enforcement. Yes, we're seeing that everywhere right now. Yeah.
And the nature of the question they're asking is telling you everything about how they see the world. But they don't know that the question is showing you everything, right? So you can just be super familiar with the topic and then see straight into somebody's mind when they ask a question. So then it can really be uncomfortable for people when you just start laying it bare, right? And it, again, it doesn't require any mojo. It's nothing supernatural. It's just when you know something inside and out, you can approach where somebody else is based on their level of not knowing.
So is it possible to read one's mind without a conversation?
I think so. I really think so, because the progress is a little more concrete in the context of martial arts. All right. So if you've ever partner danced, you know that when you get connected, like physically connect to your partner, you can feel their intention.
I've had partner dances, homeboy, and I've felt a whole bunch of intentions.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? Our sense of proprioceptive awareness is way older than vision.
Indeed.
And vision takes a while to catch up, right? So you learn through that contact to be able to discern the other person's intention through physical contact. And it could be through just crossing arms, right? Like they're reaching for you, you're reaching for them. Mm-hmm. You make contact, you can feel which direction they're going. If they're angry about it, if they're super weirdly calm, like you just feel their vibe. And the more you do it, the more skillful you get at doing it. Mm-hmm. Then after you've really learned how to tune in physically, you could then learn to read their intention before you make physical contact. So you learn to kind of feel other people's vibes based on their physicality, because there is no mind-body separation. Emotions are embodied mindset, right? Like you can tell through somebody's physical being where they are. Right. And where they want to be. So that's why sometimes you can be like, that person, they're super angry. They're looking for a target and I'm it. Right. Mm-hmm. Just all sorts of ways that you can kind of feel out other people's mojo once you've spent the time in like a training regimen. Right. So that's why it's kind of like, Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee, right? Yes. Early on, the abbot was like, your skills have gone beyond the mere physical. You are, right? You're just like, yeah, that's straight up real, man. Yeah, you can do that.
Man, I love Bruce Lee. He is so relevant right now than ever, from not only just his writings, his films, his philosophies. Man, I remember watching this Bruce Lee black and white film. I don't know where the interview came from. Uh-huh. And man, Jonathan, Bruce Lee was wearing this, it was this fitted suit. The suit was amazing. It was a fitted suit. I'm talking a vest, blazer, and fitted slim slacks that they call. So like skinny jeans now.
Yeah.
Man, I'm watching this dude move. First of all, moving in some fitted pants is kind of challenging. I mean, could you imagine kicking somebody's butt in a suit? Not in the jogging pants, not in some loose fitted yoga, Lululemon pants, but in a straight up suit. And I was blown away. And then he also talks about his philosophy. And so I'm when you mentioned Bruce Lee, man, I just sort of just lit up. Well, here's the $1 million question right now.
Yeah.
Jonathan, how do you read minds? And what, give me some of the basics. And then can you walk us through an exercise? Because I know my sound bombing community, they want to see some things. They want to see some things happen.
Got it. Okay. Let me see. Reading somebody's mind really is just information management.
Okay.
And it really boils down to telling them what to think in a way that they're not aware of, or asking them what they're thinking in a way that they're not aware of. Right. So really the way that it works is the mentalist creates a context for the audience to make logical assumptions that are later shown to not be true. That's really it, is understanding that all human beings understand within a context. You're never going to understand anything outside of, like, in just itself.
Like, I'll give you an example. Like, watching a TV show at this Brain Wars, and they do this activity where they take these numbers, and let's just say they're 12 numbers, and they ask you to remove this number, that, and then all of a sudden it's like, you're thinking of this number. And I'm like, millions of people are watching this show. How in the ham sandwich did they know that I picked the number 5 or the numbers? How does something like that work?
Right, exactly. There are just some things about it that you're not aware of. And the things you are aware of give your brain enough to feel like you know what's going on when you really don't. And once your mind comes up with an explanation, it no longer is looking for the right explanation. Mm. Right? So if you give somebody a false explanation that makes sense, they're no longer going to be looking for the real answer for something. And then they will hold on to that false explanation for dear life, because that's the thing that makes sense to them. Mm. Right? So, a demonstration that I really like to do to kind of illustrate that your mind actively filters out most information. and it would also be relevant information, valuable information. You'll ignore it if it's not in alignment with your current values.
And I'm so glad you said that. I don't know if you're familiar with Jim Quick. I love Jim Quick. He's an amazing, he's not a mentalist, but he talks about these brain hacks, and he talks about your brain being like a deletion device. Like if you kept all of this stimuli in this, you would literally go stark mad. If you're looking at my shirt, of course I'm rocking, since we're doing the show, I'm rocking my Albert Einstein shirt. How nice. Ironic. If you're trying to pay attention, so it's like a deletion device. And I'm just enamored of how the brain works, being an educator and trying to think of cool and slick ways how to hack our brain. So Jim Quick, in a lot of his work, is he teaches you how to remember things. And that's what he's known for, is he can come into a space, sort of similar like you get all these names and remember everybody's name. And he talks about the reason why we don't remember certain things is because we're not connected to people. But if you say to somebody, hey, if you can remember every name in here, I'll give you $1 million. Then you'll do that because you're connected to it, to that, with the purpose and an outcome of that thing.
Exactly. So I've got a pretty cool demonstration about this. And do you have a cell phone on you or near you?
Yep, I have one right here.
All right, put a face down on the table in front of you, right?
Okay.
And research has told us that basically we're looking at our phones a couple hundred times a day.
And if you ask my kids, I'll probably double that, a couple of thousand times.
Right, exactly. All right, so some terms first. You've got your lock screen. Like when you light it up, that's your lock screen. Yes. You put in your thumbprint or your code, and then that's your home screen. Now, you might have different pages, but there's one that's the main one. All right, so you've probably seen that home screen 500 times already just today, right? Yes. So what I'd like you to do is imagine that home screen, and in the upper left-hand corner, there's some sort of widget or app or like some folder, something is in the upper left-hand corner. Now, are you right or left-handed?
Right-handed.
Oh, I'm sorry, because left-handed people are just naturally better at this. My apologies. So there's something in the upper left-hand corner, and I want you to lock it in your mind. Do you have it in mind?
What's in the left-hand corner?
Uh-huh, yeah.
What's in the left-hand corner? Okay.
See, this should be a no-brainer, right? Like, this should be super easy, but it's not. So in just a moment, not quite yet, here's what's going to happen. You're going to turn the phone over, light it up, unlock it, check, then turn it face down again.
Okay.
All right.
So am I looking for an app or anything, or I'm looking for?
Yeah, just to double check to see if you got it right.
Okay.
All right. Well, the thing you think is in the upper left-hand corner, when you go check, is that what is actually there?
No.
Did you just checked?
I'm checking it now. Yeah.
Okay. Put it face down. Okay. Right. Like, so you got it wrong. That shouldn't have happened. Okay. Right. Because you've been exposed to that information several hundred times just today, and it's probably been there for a long time.
Yeah.
Right. And about 60% of my audiences get it wrong, which is terrifying. The weirder thing is, even if you've got an iPhone or an Android phone, everybody that just tried this out in podcast land saw exactly the same thing, which is the time on the lock screen. So did you notice exactly what time it was on your phone?
No.
See, if the time was that thing that would have gotten you $1 million, your mind would have removed it from your awareness.
Hmm.
So the thing you were invested in, the piece of information you valued, made sure that nothing else made it in.
Wow.
Right?
Wow, yes.
So that is literally why your value structure will help you ignore anything that might be contradictory to that.
Hmm.
So your value structure dictates what you're going to notice and what you're not going to notice. And the only things you're going to notice are those things that reinforce that pre-existing value structure. So all the details, all the facts, all the evidence that could prove to the contrary could be right there, but you're not going to see it.
Mm.
And that happens at every dimension, every day, in everybody's life. Like, you can't get around that process. Because just like you were talking about, if you noticed everything all the time, that's a seizure, right?
Yes, indeed.
And our brains don't have that much juice to work with, so we got to find shortcuts. So the pre-conscious, the non-conscious part of your awareness really does filter out everything that you don't value so that you've got more energy to spare to pay attention to the right stuff.
So what intrigues you, Jonathan, about the brain? Because I'm intrigued by how the brain functions as well. And then after you answer that question, what made you transition from then performing to then coaching individuals? So start with the first question. What intrigues you most about the brain?
The thing that intrigues me most about the brain is that people think there's a mind. Mm. And the mind, if you needed to point to it, is a verb. It flows out of physical reality, but is not of physical reality. Kind of in the same way that you can't point to a verb, but you can point to nouns in motion.
So the brain and the mind are two separate things.
No, I'm saying that there is no difference.
That there is no difference then, yes.
Right. So your mind is your body, mm-hmm. right? So it's kind of like mind is to brain and body as punch is to fist. Gotcha. So a punch, you can't point to a punch, but you can watch a fist move through space, right? So the mind isn't an object. It's not a thing. It is the expression of a body in motion, right? So there's no difference between the mind and the body as an expression of reality, right? So the thing that got me from performing into coaching and teaching and sharing this stuff,
I know you've gone from America's Got Talent, so you got to talk about that experience.
Yeah.
You leave the performing profession to then go into coaching. So before you get into the coaching, talk about your experience on America's Got Talent, and then why did you leave the stars, the glitz, the glamour, to then decide that you want to focus on coaching? Because I love America's Got Talent.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was grueling, but it was a lot of fun. And one of my mentors told me early on, he goes, look, anything inside the border of a television is a lie.
Wow.
None of it's true, right? It's like, those aren't little people in there. That's light, right? It's light on a panel. Mm-hmm. There's nothing real about television. Nothing. Even if it's a documentary, again, it's light on a panel. You can't poke it. It's flat, right? It's a very convincing illusion, but it's not real. So the experience of going through television making is a lot different than the audience at home experiencing what they believe that experience is, right? So the real experience is 15, 20 years worth of practice in order to be in front of the camera for that 3 minutes. And it's being able to be filming for 14 hours nonstop. You never know when there's a camera on you or not, even before you're on that stage. So you're hyper aware of being aware, right? Like, just, I'm constantly aware that if I scratch my nose, that might be the thing that makes it on national television about me, right? So you're hyper conscious of every single thing that you're doing. So you're kind of meta editing your actions before you do it. So it's double energy all the time.
which is strange, because in the real world, we aren't like that. We don't have cameras following us. If you have children like me, you have children following you, but you don't have cameras following you. And so then to always be on, that's a lot of work in and of itself.
Exactly. The going out on stage and doing what I do, That's the easiest part in the world. You know that there's 3,000 people in this auditorium live who's about ready to boo you. Okay, cool. I've been booed before. I can handle that. Oh, celebrity judges. Well, they know exactly what I'm going through because they were there when they were first starting out. Okay, cool. They're on my side. Neat. And just, that's easy. That I've done literally thousands of times. But it's the being on camera, having producers, having stagehands come up and be like, hey, you're coming with me. And you're like, oh, it's time. And they're like, no, they're just taking you to makeup, right? Or whatever. So it's just 14 hours of cortisol spike adrenaline, cortisol spike adrenaline, right? Wow. And then you're just going through the cycle of, right? Just for hours. And then you habituate to it. Basically because you're just tired and exhausted. And then they're like, okay, let's go get you mic'd up. You're like, oh, I'm doing the thing. Yeah. No, you're just getting mic'd up and you're going to be in the wings because now you got to go talk to the stagehands. Now, literally, I've spent decades of my life learning how to shuffle cards, how to feel if one card is literally 1 millimeter out of alignment. And if it's 2 millimeters out of alignment, it won't work, right? Like, it's that level of precision that I'm working with, right? Because I've spent a lifetime developing that awareness. Okay, cool. Now, imagine that you're about to go on national television, but you have to let a stagehand set your props. And they might be 5 inches out of alignment. That's not at all stressful. Right? So a big part of long-term success in high-pressure situations is learning to trust other people that they could actually do a good job, right? And they did. It was perfect. Went off without a hitch. It was great. It got 3 out of 4 yeses. It was awesome. And they never called me back. Wow. Right? So that was another piece of the puzzle is – everybody thinks that it's the judges that determine who's on the show. It's not. They can guarantee that you never come back, but even if they say yes, that is not a guarantee that you will be in the show. The producers are the people who are creating the narrative of that season.
Yeah, I get it. And if you don't fit in that narrative, then you're not chosen.
Exactly. So even if the judges said yes, that isn't a guaranteed you're going to be on next week too.
So now I see one of the reasons that you transitioned from performing to coaching. What's the difference between, or are there any similarities from performing as a minimalist
Yeah, it's all good.
I'm thinking about the documentary, man. That's a whole other conversation. I won't even get into. So what's the difference between performing to now being a coach?
Got it. The reason I transitioned was I was doing hundreds of college shows and signing autographs and posters afterwards. College kids would be like, man, I can't even imagine doing what you do. And there's two layers to that. The first one is, man, I can't even imagine doing mind reading. Like that seems impossible. Like I've grown up my entire life believing that what you just did can't happen, but I watched it happen. So I have no way to understand I can't even start imagining how it works, right? The second one is, you know, I've had this story that I've grown up with, which is I got to get good grades in school to get into a good college, to get a degree, to get a good job that can pay for my 2.54 kids so I can retire with a gold watch and a white picket fence house, right? Like, that's the standard social narrative. And if you deviate from that one iota, your life is destroyed, right? Like that's the belief structure. Then here comes me, Mr. Mind Reader Man, making jokes and scaring people for a living, right? Like how in the world do you live? Like I have no way to even start to approach how you do what you do, right? So I started talking to the kids after the show and say, well, here's how I think about stuff. You might think that I had it easy or Like, my dad grew up working in a factory. My mom's secretary. He worked 14-hour shifts to, and some days it was gas or lunch money. Not both, right? Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a single-wide trailer in the mountains of North Carolina, literally on a dirt road. Like, it was just a dirt development. That's where I grew up. So how in the world do you get from there to world traveling entertainer who has clients pay for his airfare, put him up in the world's finest hotels, and then go perform for the C-suite of BP, State Farm, United Airlines, right? Like, how in the world do you do that? So it started to become, here's how to think about things. Here's how to think about opportunities. Here's how to create opportunities. And I started getting the emails like 2 years later saying, hey, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. Here's everything that I did because of it. And it couldn't be better. Like, thank you so much for sharing your ideas. I was like, ah, dang it. Now I actually have to share this stuff, right? So the way I think about it was, as a performer, I'm doing something that's really important, which is, you know, helping people forget about their problems for just 1 hour, right? Just forget about all the troubles of the world for just this hour. We're all coming together. We're all cool. We're all here. Let's have some fun and remember what that feels like. Oh, wow. We can enjoy life even in the middle of all sorts of craziness. So that, to me, is a noble endeavor that entertainers are engaged with. But then they go right back to the problems.
Yes.
Right? So that's why sharing the meta details, the thought patterns and mindset secrets, really helps people make change long term. So over the years, the same 20-ish things kept coming up. So that's what I wrote my book about. Mm-hmm. It was basically, how can I help the most people the most quickly without me having to be physically present and spend my time one-on-one. So writing a book was the best way I knew how to do that. So now people can have conversations with me through my book and completely change how they see the world and open up more options for themselves. And all they got to do is spend some time having a conversation with me.
So explain, Jonathan, how a person gets into the top 20% of whatever they're learning. What is that process like to work with you as a coach and as a leader? And how do you help us increase that learning? Some basic things that people can do.
Yeah, the biggest secret is really doing less. That's it. I almost never, ever help my clients and training rooms and anybody that I'm working with, almost never is the answer, let's add something new. It's almost always, well, let's cut away everything that is not serving that goal. Doing much less, doing fewer things, but now you're devoting all of your energy to that one thing.
You know, Jonathan, I wish that the school system, from the superintendents to the education leader in DC, could understand that, because as an educator and as a lecturer, someone who's interested in the mind, body, and spirit, what we're seeing in education, we're constantly pushing things in. And we know education, the most natural process, is about allowing things to come out. And we're constantly pushing things in instead of allowing those things to actually happen. So to hear you say, not adding on a new app, not adding on a new device, not buying a new so-and-so, but sort of taking away some things that are not serving you. What are some things that you're hearing from some of your clients that have not, that might be consistent with maybe many of the clients that you're actually working with that aren't serving them well, some things that they're eliminating that might be similar across the board?
Ooh. Like the belief that they got to be everywhere and omnipresent.
Oh, like, I just had that conversation with my producer today. I should have had you call her on the phone. You know, she's trying to drive around to visit all these kids because it's graduation time. And I just had this conversation with her about having to, that's me as well, Jonathan. I felt like I had to be everywhere. And I don't know if it was the people pleasing or just the me. I love people. I don't really know what it was, but I felt like that when I was still teaching or just working within it with individuals that I needed to be there, walk, you know, and do what I do. And so to hear you say that, I just had this conversation with my producer about this today. Thank you. Awesome. I'm hoping she's going to be listening to this. I got to find the number as we go through the editing device to make sure I put a pin right there.
That's awesome. Well, the secret that helped me find that out is the kung fu that Bruce Lee started with. It's called Wing Chun. Yes. And it's a system. It is a complete system, start to finish, self-contained, broken up into 6 pieces. The first piece of that system is called Su Din Tao. And that loosely translates to the little idea or little mind fist. And it's a series of postures and movements that's basically, here's everything you've got to worry about. Here's 80% of the way. And as I share that with my Kung Fu students, they're almost always doing too much. They're adding way too much extra sauce to it, right?
It's funny because that's what kids say now. Mr. Shields, you're just doing too much. Mr. Pritchard, you're just doing too much. So to hear you say that they're doing too much literally is real.
Exactly. It's like, okay, here's what you need to do. This and that. That's all I need you to do. And then they're like, hook, punch it. Like why? Why are you doing all this extra? Like, you're so extra right now.
And that's what they're saying too. So this is funny. The terms that young people use, and you're actually using them in the lessons that you're working with.
Right. So that the goal of that entire form is to have you do only that which is essential. That's it. Like, don't worry about anything else. Here, focus your mind into this one spot and do what you're doing, right? Like, my mom was a Kung Fu master. She didn't know it, but she is, because she always grew up telling me, you know, Jonathan, when you cook, cook. I was like, holy, you know what? That sounds like the stupidest advice you've ever heard.
Yeah.
But how many people are doing 8 different things while they're trying to cook and then burn everything, right?
Yeah.
So the little idea is, what is the one thing that you need to be focused on? Now align your body, your mind, your intention, your spirit, your willpower, your energy, your resources, your friends, your family, your time, all of that. If you can compress all of who you are into one pinpoint, what in the world is going to stop you?
Mm. So, Jonathan, how has your being a mentalist supported your efforts of being a Kung Fu master? And how has your efforts of being a Kung Fu master supported your gift of being a mentalist?
They play together very well. They really play together. And if somebody is overly concrete and literal, right? Kung Fu isn't going to be as useful because it's already the way they relate. And they're using the way they relate to build those roadblocks. So you could use some mind reading tricks and some metaphor and interesting visualizations that are non-logical, but super effective to kind of flip their minds. And they have no way to defend it because they're so used to dealing with concrete reality. Well, okay, if there's somebody that's way out there in la-la land and believes a whole bunch of wacky stuff that isn't in alignment with reality, you know, punching them in the face is one of the most loving things you can do, right? That'll bring you right back to now.
You know,
right?
It's funny. I just asked a kid a couple of days ago, and my business partner, Davey, used to say this all the time. When was the last time somebody punched you in the face? It always catches people off guard, like, well, I've never been punched in the face. Well, you know what? You probably need to be punched in the face right now.
Exactly. I love that as shorthand of you've been protected from the effects of your decisions for too long.
Say that again, man. I love that. That's a tweetable, as Oprah Winfrey says. Say that one more time.
You've been protected from the consequences of your actions or your reality for too long. Right? Because it's allowed you to believe things that are out of alignment with cause and effect.
Mm.
That's it. right? So that to me is the literal power of Kung Fu and any kind of physical practice like that. It forces you to be here in the real world where things matter.
So speaking about being here, Jonathan, how do you prepare for a show? And how do you prepare for maybe sparring with someone on the Kung Fu mat? Are they similar or are they different? What are some of the rituals and routines that you do to prepare yourself to interact with other people?
That is a really insightful question.
Come on, man, Jonathan, stop playing games, dude. You know, this is me now. We've been talking for an hour. I'm asking some of the best questions because you are amazing and I don't want to waste your time, nor do I want to waste the time with the sound bombing community.
You are setting gold standard here. All right, so the show is a carefully orchestrated, managed event down to the pauses I have in my speech. Right, like I'm managing millimeters of my hands doing something, right? Like even in a room of 1,000 people, there's still details of a millimeter that matter. And it's carefully planned, orchestrated, and executed in real time. So I'm managing the experience of 1,000 people. So there can't be any portion of success left up to chance. You can leave room for improvement and in the moment creativity, but you can't leave success up to chance. Mm. Okay, so there's that. Dynamic situation like sparring, complete opposite. Complete opposite. Because if you go in thinking, well, first this is going to happen, then this is going to happen, then after that I'm going to do this, good luck. Say goodnight, right? So really, you've got to practice and cultivate your skills over time so that you can be free and in the moment and completely spontaneous in the sparring situation. So it's more of an openness and willingness to meet the moment and to trust your training for you to make the best decision about what to do in this particular dynamic. So it's kind of the complete opposite end of the spectrum, right?
Wow.
So you could go in with that plan, and what is it, Mike Tyson, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth?
You get punched in the mouth, yes, indeed. Yep,
that's exactly it. So that points to something I call real time and echo time.
So unpack that for me.
So going back to the sense of touch is very direct, and you can kind of feel somebody's intention. And vision is really processor heavy. It takes a lot of our cognitive ability for our minds to make sense of what you're looking at. And it takes about 300 milliseconds, about a third of a second, to really know what's going on, right? Proprioceptive touch, like touch, is so much more ancient and quick. We know exactly what we're feeling, right? That's why if you feel what your dance partner is doing, you can both stay in time. If you are watching the feet of your partner, you're always going to be behind, right? So real time is being so good at being present that you are in the moment. Echo time is thinking about what you think is happening. So you're always going to be at least half a second too late. Which is why really good martial artists can be exactly where you don't want them to be. No matter what you're trying to do, they just are always in exactly the most frustrating position. You're like, what is going on? Well, it's because they are fully present and responding in relationship with the current dynamic in a spontaneous way. Whereas you are trying to run your game plan and think about what you should do next. If you're thinking about hitting the baseball, goes right past you. If you're thinking about tackling that guy, you're going to get knocked out, right? It's like thinking about doing the thing takes you out of the present moment. and you totally crush the ability to respond in a creative way. So when you're fully engaged in the moment, when you're in the flow, you're properly in relationship with the dynamic, really cool spontaneous stuff happens. That's real time where things really are happening, and you could actually influence them and have an impact by embracing the dynamic. If you're pushing them away, you're limiting your ability to make that influence. And then if you're thinking about what it is you think you're going to do, well, now you're echo, right? You're the echo of reality, and the sound is always going to come before the echo.
So speaking of real time and echo time, Jonathan, is it super bomb questions time right now? Because I can take time and talk to you forever, but I want to, and now it's time for the super bomb questions. This is my favorite part of the show. First of all, you've enlightened me, and I know my audience 100 times out. And so I want to ask you the super bomb question. So are you ready, Jonathan?
I thought I was at the beginning, but based on the quality and insightfulness of your previous questions, I'm a little scared and excited.
I think you're ready for this, man. This is easy. So you ready? Let's go. What's your favorite word?
Ooh, pulchritudinous.
What's your favorite quote?
Illegitimus non carborundum.
What's your superpower?
Mind reading.
What's your animal spirit?
Ooh, dragon.
What brings you to tears of joy?
Finishing a painting.
What moves you to tears of sorrow?
Ooh, thinking about when I could have been better.
What do you wish you had more time to do?
Be with people that matter.
What dead person would you like most to meet or get advice from?
Buckminster Fuller.
What is the book or books that you've given most as a gift, and why?
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Great, great book. Great book. Walk me through your morning routine.
The alarm goes off at 7. I put my feet on the ground. I run through the Su Nim Tao Kung Fu system, right? So I start off by Kung Fu, then usually coffee, then maybe play some Mario Odyssey, and then it's to the computer to start the workday.
What is one of the best or most worthwhile investments you've ever made?
Learning Kung Fu.
Well, Jonathan Pritchard, I want to thank you for joining me in the Bomb Shelter. Thank you for joining me on Sound Bombing today. You've been amazing. And I know I told my guests that you were going to wow them, and I enjoyed it. So, man, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. It is such a delight to be surprised and to be taken places I've never seen before. So I very much appreciate it.
Well, that's what we attempt to do here. And also, I could not do this without my great engineer, Alec Blanc, my producer, Nicole Klimpaka Supremacy, for our theme music, and all of you for listening. Make sure you subscribe. Stop being stingy. We're on every platform. Please share me with all of your friends and all your families. And many people are quarantined anyway, so they have nothing else to do. Tell them to tune in to Sound Bomb. If you don't know more about me, you can visit drlds.com. And as always, believe something wonderful is about to happen. And some people miss the message because they're too busy looking for the mess. Thanks for tuning in. And you've been listening to Sound Bombing. Go out and do something for someone other than yourself today. Peace.